This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, you have your W-2 forms, any other forms you may need to be able to prepare yourself for the income tax returns you're going to have to file here before too long. Well, how do you better prepare for tax season? That's why we turn now to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer to take a look at the issues and the things that have changed dramatically with the changes in the tax laws. Greg, as always, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first here talking about the gathering of having all your ducks in a row, so to speak, here. It's very important to have all the documents that you think you're going to need either on hand if you're going to do it yourself, you're going to use any kind of automated software, or you're going to turn it over to your financial advisor.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, this year a lot of people are going to realize that some of the information in the past that was relevant won't be relevant, but it could be relevant in, different planning opportunities. But we always tell people W-2s are the obvious, but make sure there's things that you didn't do during the year that maybe were different with the distribution, or maybe open a different account that could have generated another 1099. And we always warn people with brokerage accounts, make sure that it's a final brokerage account, because a lot of times they'll get one out there because of the deadline and end up issuing a revised one.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the paperwork that you need, you talk about 1099s in particular, what's out there that you need to be aware of that you may have to take advantage of?
Well, a lot of people may have started a different type of savings account. Maybe it could be as simple as a CD at a bank where there's an interest statement coming. And, the past few years, as you know, that never really related to a large amount, but interest rates have risen. So those statements that you may not have been getting before, money sitting in, money market accounts or CDs that you converted, might actually generate 1099s where in the past they didn't. And then, again, there's some things unique to if you moved money, rolled one over to, one qualified plan to another. While they don't often impact the tax return, they should be reported on the tax return.
And probably Social Security paperwork, too, is probably important as well if you haven't gotten already. Of course, it may be delayed, too, because of the partial government shutdown.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people just that have gotten in the past are familiar with what they get in the past. So you just got to be cognizant that you got everything. I always tell people it's fine to go in and begin the tax process early if you like to get it done quickly, but just make sure that it matches up. If you haven't used that previous tax preparer, or if you're thinking about doing it on your own, to make sure that it's matching up with everything that you had the previous year. That's usually a pretty good checks and balances.
One thing we know, too, that there are some new tax forms that we have to deal with these days. Tell us about that and what kind of impact that the average taxpayer and tax return filer will have to know about.
Well, and, the strange thing about it, Chris, is they're not even all out yet. So, as preparers ourselves, we're still waiting to look at some of them and see some of the new ones. But, yeah, it's going to be an entirely different format. They're trying to simplify the actual 1040 because of the way they're structuring the standard deduction now. So there will be some new looks and some things to get familiar with. And that could bring value to using a preparer still to make sure that you're not missing anything because of the simplification on the forms.
Mm-hmm. Also, too, I guess we've kind of talked about the fact that many people, of course, take advantage of the new automated ways to be able to put your tax return together and to file it with the state and the federal governments. But I guess the question comes down to whether you're going to do it yourself or whether you're going to turn it over to somebody else.
Absolutely. And there are times where we'll mention to somebody, hey, this is something you might want to do just online. It's simple. The thing to be just aware of, I think most people realize there's nothing free. So all free softwares, they give you the software, but then there's generally a cost associated with filing your physical return online so that it's common sense, right? So if you want to be cost effective, just make sure you're aware of those do-it-yourselves and what type of total cost it would take, not only just to get the software, but to actually go ahead and complete. And in that area, we always tell people, there's two things to taxes, preparation and planning. If you're just looking to prepare your taxes, a lot of times those softwares are going to be very, very effective and you're prepping your taxes. But if you're looking to see, hey, am I missing some things? Is there some things I'm not thinking? Is there ways that I could potentially change the input instead of just putting it in and finding out the result? that's where planning becomes involved, and that's where, you know, the value of a tax professional could be added.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer here about some of the changes and things to be aware of here with the changes in the new tax laws and all. One point in particular I know is, and we bring it up here occasionally, and this time of year especially, is the importance of the W-4 and making sure that it's correct. Tell us about that.
Well, I think the biggest thing with the W-4 that people got to realize, the government wanted these monies to be put into the economy throughout the year last year. So there was a lot of adjustments made on withholdings relative to the new tax laws. So one of the things that, you know, might come as quite of a surprise to a lot of folks, and, you know, we were proactive with a lot of our clients in that looking at these withholdings, they changed them. You know, so what you were used to or what you were accustomed to getting, either in the refund or what you were familiar with, what you need to cover for a tax obligation to break even, could have changed. And the new laws don't necessarily equate to lower taxes for everybody. And a lot of folks that were using their returns for savings to pay, you know, property taxes, as an example, to pay for a college tuition, you know, they tweaked those W-4 holdings to the new laws in most organizations. So a lot of those benefits would have been changed to a way where, you know, somebody that was normally expecting a larger refund to pay for something that they had earmarked through that refund may be surprised. And that's where you need to go and, you know, revisit the W-4, what the withholdings are, and adjust them back to where, you know, you were comfortable in the past.
Okay. And finally here, let's take a look here. We know we get the returns done, but sometimes there are things that get in the way of making sure that that return is completely completed and ready to file. If not already filed, you may have to do an extension. Tell us about the situation now with the changes about filing an extension if necessary.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very useful tool. As I tell individuals, filing the extension can give you that extra opportunity. The one thing we always mention to folks, whether you're in the new law or the old law, filing an extension doesn't file the deadline for your tax obligation.
Right.
So if you do owe money, you know, you want to make sure you have a pretty accurate idea and pay that as a prepayment by the April deadline. But if you don't have anything, you're not sure, it's just prudent to say, you know what, let me file an extension, get as close as I can to my estimate so that I'm not waiting on documents. A lot of times the brokerage statements, they'll indicate that they're going to send a revised form, a lot of trusts, K-1 schedules, things that normally don't come out to mid-March where you're getting them at the end of March, could be things that you're just not sure if you have everything yet. So be willing and able to file an extension. Just make sure that you're covering your tax obligation, you know, as you come into that deadline.
Now, will the State Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service accept pretty much if you do the best you can and come as close in your estimate to what you actually may owe and send that in, will that at least be able to, in the meantime, give you an opportunity to get your extension done and then make up the balance or whatever you have?
So, unfortunately, they're not as forgiving past the April 15th deadline. What they are more forgiving on is if you put in enough tax obligation or withholdings based on what your previous tax experience was, there's a safe harbor.
Yeah.
But as you begin to get into things that you know occurred during the year, if you're not pretty close in guessing that, you know, because you can estimate those things in a return, if you get to substantial amounts, the deadline is April 15th. So they can tag interest and penalties on those obligations. So, you know, often it's more err the side of caution, pay more than what you think, and then when you file your extension, you get a refund, and you eliminate the potential for those penalties and interest charges.
Awesome. Very interesting and important things to know as we all get ready for getting the returns, whether it's a state or a federal income tax return together. And as always, we thank you very much, Greg, for giving us the latest information, and we'll check back here as we get a little closer to that April 15th deadline, because I'm sure there'll be some more changes we'll probably have to talk about.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate the time.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Industry and East Chicago have gone hand in hand for more than a century. Nowhere is that more evident than in the city's historic planned worker community, Marktown. The neighborhood is sandwiched between a massive steel plant and one of the nation's largest oil refineries, BP. The company for years has been buying homes and buildings in Marktown and clearing them away. Many remaining residents want to leave too, but they say that BP's been offering them way less than what their homes are worth. And Michael Puente offers this look at what's happening in this historic neighborhood near the Whiting Refinery Complex.
Ricardo Maldonado offers coffee and pastries to his neighbors. They gather in his dining room last week to discuss their homes and their future in this neighborhood called Marktown. It was built more than a century ago by industrialist Clayton Mark so workers could live near his factory. Marktown's unique Tudor-style English homes are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But let's not over-romanticize this place. Although the rent and home prices are affordable, it can be hard to live here. It's isolated from the rest of the city of East Chicago. No grocery stores, no schools within walking distance. Residents say the worst part is the air quality.
¿Quién quiere vivir con tanta contaminación? La contaminación.
That's Olivia Chalwance. She's lived in the neighborhood with her husband Juan and their two children for 7 years. She says in Spanish, who wants to live here near so much contamination, the contamination and the odor. Here, Olivia says she prohibits her children from playing outside because of the pollution. Olivia says she and her neighbors want to move, but BP isn't offering enough money for their homes.
This house, you know, I paid $30,000 and I put $20,000 because I fix it.
This is Ricardo Maldonado, whose house we are in. He bought his home 14 years ago and he thinks it's worth much more now.
And I don't think it's fair if they offer me $30,000, you know. I think something fair is around 50 or 60, something like that.
BP has offered, in my opinion, a very unjust and unfair value that goes from $20,000 and in some cases $30,000.
Juan Villarreal is a licensed real estate broker who's representing 26 of the remaining 60 or so homeowners in their dealings with BP. Marktown once had more than 200 homes and duplexes, but many have been torn down over the years and their occupants relocated. Villarreal says some homeowners aren't allowed to talk about their dealings with BP. They often make decisions in the dark.
Sometimes we're given an ultimatum by brokers that represent BP, suggesting that if they didn't take the offer now, which would be on an average of $20,000 to $30,000, that they would be lucky if BP would even offer them half. And so there's a lot of scare tactics.
BP's Director of Media Affairs, Michael Abenhoff, says in a statement that the company has been purchasing property around the refinery for more than 20 years in an effort to create more green space. That means clearing away the historic structures and potentially displacing residents. In his statement, Abenhoff says in all cases, the properties were purchased from willing sellers. Where there were safety hazards, BP had the purchased properties demolished or removed, he says. Abenhoff insists BP always negotiates in good faith. East Chicago City Councilman Robert Garcia, who represents Marktown, thinks otherwise.
BP just don't understand. Them homes might not be worth much, but a lot of those residents and homeowners have their homes paid off, and that's priceless to them.
The company hasn't said why it wants to clear the homes, but local environmental activist Thomas Frank has an idea. He says after the fatal explosion at BP's Texas City refinery in 2005, the company wants a buffer between its facility and residential areas.
They're mitigating against the potential for a blast.
Frank says it will be difficult to find a home anywhere for the amount BP is offering.
Where do you go from Marktown? And you're just not going to find a home that you can buy at $14,000 and not have to pay enormous amount of mortgage.
Marktown homeowner Juan Rivas faces that real possibility.
Si no, ¿para dónde nos vamos a ir?
He says, where are we going? With $20,000, we won't get anything. I'm Michael Puente.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest on Green Fleet Radio is Mr. Ken Brown. He's a Senior Advisor for Government Affairs for Transportation Energy Partners, or TEP. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carl. Glad to be here.
Ken, tell our listeners, what is Transportation Energy Partners, and what do you do?
Well, Transportation Energy Partners is a national nonprofit organization, and we work with the nation's 90 clean cities coalitions and their many stakeholders in the clean transportation industry. And our focus is to work on federal policy that promotes and advances markets for cleaner transportation technologies and cleaner fuels like electric vehicles, natural gas vehicles, biofuels, hydrogen, propane, and other advanced fuels and technologies.
Right. You know, I know TEP has worked on some federal policies priorities this year. So how are those priorities determined, Ken?
So we have a board of directors that's made up of Clean Cities Coalition leaders such as yourself and other industry leaders across the country. And our board of directors sets our policy priorities each year. And they're looking for those policies that are most pressing and those that have the greatest opportunities to advance markets for cleaner fuels and vehicles.
So if there was one key issue TEP worked on federal policy priority, and what was that issue in 2018?
Well, it's hard to zero in on one issue, but there are four main things that we worked on, or actually five main things that we worked on in the past year. One is we've been very active in promoting increased funding for two important federal programs that support the Clean Cities Coalitions and our partners in the clean transportation industry. One is the Department of Energy Clean Cities Program, and we were successful in saving that program from proposed elimination by the administration and, in fact, actually increasing funding up to nearly $40 million for the current fiscal year. And we'll be working again on that next year. The other is there's a program called the EPA Clean Diesel Grant. Mm-hmm. And that's a program that provides funding for projects and technologies that will replace outmoded diesel engines and diesel technologies with newer, cleaner technologies. And we were successful in increasing funding for that program up to $75 million. Another area we've been working on is to extend the tax incentives for alternative fuels and vehicles. Those were we were successful in extending them through the end of 2017. However, they're now currently expired through 2018, and we'll be working hard to see if we can get those extended again through 2018 and then again into 2019. And another interesting area that we've been working on is the current Department of Transportation has held up funding through its what's called the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Program. It's a federal highways program that provides funding for technologies and strategies that will clean the air in communities that are suffering from inferior air quality. Mm-hmm. And the current Department of Transportation has delayed and stalled funding for that program, and we're trying to break that logjam and get that funding going. It provides funding for hundreds of vehicles across the country, and in fact, the city of Chicago has a program where they are looking to use this funding to help build new electric charging infrastructure and purchase a number of electric vehicles throughout the Chicago region. And that funding has been held up for the city of Chicago. So we're working with Chicago and many other communities around the country to see if we can free up that funding.
Sure. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Ken Brown, Senior Advisor for Government Affairs for Transportation Energy Partners. So, Ken, I know TEP's big annual Energy Independence Summit is coming up in February. So tell our listeners a little bit about that event.
Yeah, this is a very important event for those interested in cleaner fuels and technologies. Each year we gather in Washington, D.C. This coming year it's going to be February 11th through the 13th in Washington, D.C. We bring together the nation's clean cities coalitions, leading industries in the clean transportation market, and other key state and local government, federal government stakeholders to to share information, network with each other. And then a big part of the event is to meet with our policymakers within the various federal agencies and the Congress to educate them about the many great things that local clean cities coalitions like yours, Carl, and many others around the country are doing to advance and promote cleaner fuels and vehicles, to help fleets convert their vehicles to cleaner technologies. And it's really important that we each year educate our policymakers so they know how important these federal programs and tax incentives are, and understand the impact that they have in thousands of communities all over the country.
Sure. And I know, Ken, you know, this event, I know it's very extensive. There's a lot of great networking, but this is generally open to anybody that would like to attend, correct?
Yes, it is. This is for people who are extremely experienced and knowledgeable, and also people who are just interested in learning more and want to be part of the national movement to convert our transportation system to cleaner and more efficient technologies.
So how can our listeners learn more about Transportation Energy Partners and the upcoming summit?
The best way to do that is to go to our website, and that is www.transportationenergypartners.org. That's www.transportationenergypartners.org.
And Ken, as
you can learn about the TEP and learn about the summit.
Well, Ken, we thank you for your leadership, and that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mr. Ken Brown, Senior Advisor for Government Affairs for Transportation Energy Partners, or TEP. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday at about 12:20 here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. The podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available, too, online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. A Hoosier lawmaker says that students who don't want to dissect animals in school should have other options. Gary, Democrat Representative Reagan Hatcher, is proposing a bill that, if it's passed and put into law, would require schools to provide an alternative to animal dissections for students who requested it. She says there are other newer options that seem to make sense.
Today, there's so many more alternatives available, like the virtual dissection and different forms of technology in the classroom.
She says schools should limit the harm that's done to animals for these procedures, especially since it might not relate to many students' future careers.
And just for us to kill frogs or kill whatever they're dissecting in the classroom to get that experience, when most of the students there aren't going to go into the medical field at all, seems a bit overboard.
The legislation says schools will have to provide alternatives, which include a virtual program or other projects that use multimedia or even trips to a zoo. A national animal welfare group says at least 18 other states have similar laws. Reagan Hatcher's bill has yet to be scheduled for a hearing in the Indiana House Education Committee. The deadline for committees to hear bills is in about 2 weeks. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, which is based in Indianapolis, has been putting together a program which is entitled Prevention Matters. And in that program, which helps organizations, schools in particular, set up drug prevention programs, they've been able to provide funds to help these school systems get these projects started. Programs have started in several schools around the state as of last year. And just recently, they've also set aside more than $1 million to help some Marion County K-12 schools implement drug prevention programs. We're going to check into one similar initiative that's set up here in Northwest Indiana with the help of Prevention Matters, and it's coming out of LaPorte County. Claire Finnegan-Green is the president and CEO of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, and she is with us to talk about it. Claire, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, for people that maybe are not all that familiar with the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, tell us a little about the foundation, how it got started, and the wide extent of support that it does to organizations here in the Hoosier State.
Sure. So we are a private charitable foundation that was established by our founder, Richard Fairbanks. And when he passed away in 2000, the assets from his company settled into the foundation. And so we are a little over $300 million in assets, and we make grants to benefit the people of the city of Indianapolis. As part of our work, we do statewide research and some policy work that has impact on people in Indianapolis, and one of those areas is the opioid crisis.
That's right. That's right. In fact, there's some sad statistics that, of course, have come out among many that have happened here. Certainly the most recent of which we'll mention, and you may be aware of, too, is that LaPorte County government has just filed a federal court lawsuit up here in court in Hammond against the pharmaceutical companies, and they are blaming the big pharma, as they're called, with providing the wherewithal to allow the drugs, the medications, but to end up becoming drugs to get out there in the pipeline, and in turn just fuel the opioid overdose problem. One of the statistics that comes up, maybe people are not aware of, is that Americans are more likely to die from an opioid overdose than they are from an auto accident. And they mentioned statistics of more than 1,800 Hoosier overdose deaths just in 2017 alone. So that's pretty sad news. And the fact that we have more opioid overdose deaths coming about than even those people who die prematurely from cigarette smoking. These are all very, very sobering statistics, to say the least. How do these all fit in together that the foundation helps make the Prevention Matters program work?
Yeah, so we took a look at the landscape as we were learning about the opioid crisis and its impact on Indiana. And also, you mentioned our very high smoking rate. Indiana has one of the highest smoking rates in the country. And we took a look at what were the available resources coming from the state and other funders to help address these crises. And we saw the biggest emphasis was on helping people get into treatment who were struggling right now with an opioid use disorder or addiction. What we didn't see a lot of was prevention, and we thought the old adage certainly holds true that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So we decided to put together an initiative that we call Prevention Matters, and we identified the very best proven prevention programs that actually start as early as elementary school, and we launched, with the support of our board, a $12 million initiative over 3 years to help connect K-12 schools with proven substance use prevention programs, grades K through 12. Mm-hmm. So we have committed $11.9 million toward that initiative, and we believe very strongly that we should collaborate with everybody who's trying to tackle the opioid crisis and other substance use challenges around the state, including meth or whatever the challenge might be in a given community. So we have partnered with other foundations like the LaPorte County Foundation, to help give them the tools that we've used in Marion County so that they can replicate Prevention Matters in their own community.
That's important, I think, to note that besides coming up with the grants to help school corporations and individual schools put together these K through 12 prevention programs, it's all showing that that education is all basically the way that you help get the word out to not only start very young, but even to grown-ups as well, I imagine, to let them know that it's not wise to find yourself in the situation where you might become addictive to such drugs.
That's absolutely right, yes. And if you start as early as elementary school, what you're really doing is helping equip students with good decision-making skills so that when they're presented with an opportunity to try a drug or to experiment with alcohol, they might make a better choice. And in fact, the proven prevention programs that our initiative is supporting have proven just that they are effective at helping young people make not only good short-term decisions, but long-term decisions that help them avoid problems with addiction over the long term.
I know you've had a chance to look through a lot of the paperwork that comes about from the organizations that have asked to be involved in the prevention program, Partners in Prevention in particular, which is the one that the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte has established. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how it's gotten started and in turn has certainly gotten the attention of the Fairbanks Foundation to begin with?
Yes. Yeah, so as I mentioned, we believe very strongly in collaboration, and we convene a group of funders from all around the state, including the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, who are interested in trying to tackle the opioid crisis and other substance misuse challenges in their community. And so as we were developing Prevention Matters, we shared all of the information that we had developed and the research we'd done and tools, as well as the design of our Prevention Matters initiative. And the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, under the direction of Maria Fruth, the president and CEO, took the initiative to adapt that model for LaPorte County, and they call it Partners in Prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly would defer to her for more details about how they are going about doing that, but we have been very happy to come alongside them and provide information and resources to them as they launch that initiative serving schools in LaPorte County.
I would imagine that probably in each instance here, for each organization that has gotten financial assistance through the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, that they all have their own certain little type of program. And certainly in this case, that the Partners in Prevention for LaPorte County is the same way, too. But there have to be some common keys, I would imagine, between all of them to be able to get the funding support and to become part of this overall, I guess you could call it a network, I suppose, in a way of drug prevention programs. What are, if there are any particular points or keys that they all seem to have in common?
Yeah, so I think the very first is the willingness of the leadership of the school and the teachers and other staff in the school to provide this type of programming to students, and we've seen lots of enthusiasm from schools that are involved in prevention initiatives. And then we have a very select group of proven prevention programs that applicants were allowed to select from, and so we connected them with technical assistance providers who are experienced with implementing prevention programs in schools to help schools identify the program that best met the population needs of the students that they are serving and the community in which they're located. So that was number one, is making sure it's actually a proven prevention program that has long-term evidence that it's effective at helping young people avoid substance misuse and eventually addiction. The second is these programs really are all about, at their essence, social and emotional well-being. It's equipping students with good decision-making tools so that will serve them well in all areas of their life, and certainly when it comes to making good decisions about drugs and alcohol. So those are key. And then the final thing is making sure that it's a cost-effective program, and all of the ones that we selected are cost-effective and can be sustained over the long term. Once they get up and running, the schools figure out how to incorporate the program into the regular school schedule and then train their staff so that it can be provided over the long term within their school.
Now, since these are pretty much based towards schools and the young people, of course, going to grades K through 12, are there any programs that maybe is part of what they do that is part of this overall Prevention Matters program will help high school students, of course, are in the list, but young adults in particular, or even older adults out in the communities that they may serve, will they be able to help benefit from this as well?
Well, certainly the tools that students learn when they're in school, including in high school, will carry over when they go on to post-secondary education or into the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we are just focused on prevention grades K through 12. I do know that the Indiana State Chamber of Commerce is working on putting together a toolkit to help employers around the state figure out how they can help their employees address addiction, and that includes prevention on the front end so that people make good choices about whether or not they're going to take a certain substance or try a drug that might have been prescribed legally to them, and certainly good decision-making about illegal drugs.
If there's any place that anyone can find more information about the overall Prevention Matters program, and perhaps, of course, they can, of course, find out more locally, in this case with LaPorte County, by getting in touch with the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte and individually, is there any place that the Prevention Matters program overall has information people can check out if they'd like to find out more, especially since they may be concerned about programs that might be set up in their school?
Certainly, yes. So on our website, which is RM as in Mary, FF as in Frank, .org/Prevention Matters. People can visit, look for information on our website. And then I do encourage people in LaPorte to obviously take a look at the resources available at the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte and on their website.
Well, thank you very much for giving us the great information here, Claire. And we hope that people, and certainly this example with the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte, maybe we'll go prompt some other folks if they have programs that they're considering setting up drug prevention programs in their areas as well, and they are looking for some way to get some assistance or finding out at least the right way to set it up, that what they can learn from the overall Prevention Matters program is going to help out. And even though we know that the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation is providing the funding for these particular programs, it might spur some other ones popping up soon.
Absolutely. And I encourage your listeners to also have conversations with the young people in their lives. That also matters. But certainly connect with their schools to make sure that evidence-based, proven prevention programs are being provided in the classroom as well.
Well, Claire, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain the Prevention Matters program and talk about the big investment that the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation has made to not only to the central Indiana, but to other communities in Indiana to help implement these drug prevention programs. And we hope that we get to hear some good news to come back as well, too, in the future.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Claire Fidian Green is the president and CEO of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation based in Indianapolis. Two Indiana state lawmakers, one Republican, one Democrat, have proposed a bill that is coming up in the General Assembly this session that would try to address some of the very serious gaps in current environmental law in Indiana that involves factory farm pollution. You know what that is, and primarily you know it as the way it's called, CAFOs, or confined animal feeding operations. This bill introduced is coming up in a hearing before the Indiana House Environmental Affairs Committee. And it has a direct impact on Northwest Indiana one way or the other. It is because of the recent approval by the Indiana Department of Environmental Management of a CAFO permit for Natural Prairie Dairy located in Newton County. Let's talk with Kim Ferraro. She's the Hoosier Environmental Council's Agricultural Policy Director, and she's also a senior staff attorney who's closely watching what the legislature does on this. Kim, thanks for joining us here on the program.
Chris, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us, if you will, a little bit first about what House Bill 1378, as what it's called in the agenda before the General Assembly, is all about, and why the Hoosier Environmental Council is very much in support of it.
Yes, thanks for your interest in the question. So as your listeners may know, the Hoosier Environmental Council is a statewide advocacy organization, and helping communities who are suffering from undue pollution impacts is something that we've been doing for more than 30 years. I can't think of any more serious and chronic issue that we've been dealing with over that time as the pollution from factory farms or CAFOs. And what we continue to hear repeatedly over and over again all across the state is that current law is not protecting people. Current law is not protecting people's groundwater from leaching and overflowing waste lagoons, and many of most people who live in rural communities rely on well water, so it's a public health threat. People are telling us that their quality of life, their air quality, their very ability to live in their own homes has been devastated by the noxious air pollution that we know is emitted from these massive animal factories. And what they hear from their local county leaders and then from the state agency IDEM that is supposed to be protecting human health and the environment from pollution is unable to help. And that's simply because the law that we have right now is inadequate. 1378 would address the many regulatory gaps that we see in current law. And just to provide two major highlights, although we know that from Purdue and EPA studies and other studies going back at least two decades, that factory farms generate as much hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, VOCs, and other noxious odorous compounds as other regulated Clean Air Act industrial facilities, yet they are completely exempt, wholly exempt, under the Federal Clean Air Act and any state air regulations. So 1378 would address that by requiring pollution controls on CAFOs. The other major gap is that IDEM, unlike with other industries, has no authority under the current regulation to deny or revoke a permit for a CAFO if it becomes a public health or environmental threat, as long as it is complying with the very minimal sort of setback cookie-cutter requirements that are in existence now.
I know in particular when we talk about the Natural Prairie Dairy application that the IDEM just recently approved and then in turn will allow the operation to get going there in Newton County. It's got a special situation, perhaps more so than other CAFO permits because of the concern of where it is located. We've talked about this before, but it probably bears repeating about the location that the owners of the property want to set up this organic dairy farm. Tell us about that and why it certainly fits into what this particular bill, if it does get turned into law, might be able to remedy.
Yeah, I think that this situation is a prime example of how current law has failed the environment and rural communities. So the Natural Prairie Dairy site is right smack in the middle of the former lake bed of Beaver Lake, mm-hmm. which used to be, before it was drained at the end of the 1800s, used to be the largest natural lake, inland lake in Indiana. And that lake was drained for farming purposes, drained to raise crops. And what it left behind is what's called a surficial or unconsolidated sand aquifer that sits very, very close to the surface and often results in flooding and ponding in the area. So this aquifer naturally then is highly susceptible to contamination waste that we know will be spread on the ground, will be stored in a massive waste lagoon that's 9 acres in size, which is basically 7 football fields. And this aquifer is what area residents rely on for their drinking water. They have wells that tap into this aquifer. So it's a direct public health threat, not to mention the unregulated noxious odors. And because this CAFO, proposed CAFO, you know, meets the very minimal setbacks from residences and surface waters, IDEM had to approve it. And so, you know, it essentially, you know, there are issues. We believe that Natural Prairie has violated some Clean Water Act laws in permitting, but ultimately IDEM, you know, made a decision otherwise to say that, no, it meets the requirements of the current regulation, so we have to approve it.
Do you get the impression that in coming up with the creation of House Bill 1378, which we should probably mention right here at the outset, this topic has obviously come up before, and measures have come up before the General Assembly, but never made it very far. In this case here, with Representatives Tom Saunders and Sue Arrington, who are both, by the way, from East Central Indiana, but they're out in rural areas, except for Representative Arrington. She's from Muncie, but she's out there in the middle of the area, which is prime farmland in the Hoosier State. Then they are very concerned, I'm sure, about the factory farms, and they probably have factory farms in their area in particular that has probably brought up concerns to them. Yes. Do they seem to think that that this is one reason why they keep wanting to be sure at least it comes back up in the hopes that it'll be enacted by the General Assembly?
Yeah, both lawmakers have had recent controversies in their own districts regarding CAFOs that also highlight the need for this law. In Representative Saunders' district, there was a church camp that found a 30-year-old church camp with little kids that come every summer, ages 4 to 17, to stay, you know, for overnight camps and outdoor cabins, you know, like we all love to do as kids. And a massive dairy CAFO was approved right next to it, and unfortunately, even despite the kids that were there and the known public health threats to them, there was nothing that we were able to do. You know, we bought permit appeals, we bought zoning appeals, and ultimately, you know, the law was held to allow that CAFO to proceed. And similarly, in Representative Arrington's district, there's a massive 10,000-head hog CAFO that's been approved very near the Mississinewa River and surrounded by more than 200 residential homes. And again, IDEM approved that one. So, you know, there's just example after example where communities are being unprotected under current law.
We're talking with Kim Ferraro with the Hoosier Environmental Council about what is called House Bill 1378. It's a measure that Representative Saunders and Representative Arrington have co-authored, which is up in the General Assembly this session, that would deal with some of the gaps in current Indiana environmental law that pertains to what are referred to as factory farms and the pollution that they have been documented to have created. And, of course, we're concerned about all this because of the recent permit that has been granted by the state for the Natural Prairie Dairy operation, which would be in Newton County. Kim, even though in this particular case that the Natural Prairie Dairy Farm CAFO permit has been approved, if this bill is enacted into law, is there any possibility that it'll have any impact on the farm operations, or will this mainly make sure that nothing like this happens again?
Well, it certainly would help ensure that nothing like this happens again, but because the bill would impose air emission limits and give IDEM the authority to revoke a permit if a CAFO becomes a public health threat, it would give IDEM the authority to pull this permit that it issued to Natural Prairie. So potentially, if it became law, it could turn things around.
Yeah, so they'd be more police action, so to speak, you know, by IDEM if something goes wrong. They'd have the teeth in the law to tell them to tell the farm that you've got to stop this stuff or order them, you know, or either take it to court, I suppose, even, and get a court order to get these things resolved if there are any problems, too. When you talk about the problems that factory farm pollution can cause, not only to drinking water and to farm operations for the residents in the areas where they are near, and you talk about, in this case, the children's camp over in eastern Indiana that lived right, that are basically set up right next to the CAFO, and the problems elsewhere. In our particular case here, we have a wildlife area, so you have danger to wildlife areas, and one well-established, one by the Nature Conservancy.
Correct, that's right, and you know, there's been millions of dollars spent by the Nature Conservancy over time to restore the beautiful native prairie and wetland areas, and those areas are literally right next to this, to the Natural Prairie CAFO site. And, you know, I don't know if folks really understand the magnitude of the size that this CAFO will be. It will have 4,350 dairy cattle producing more waste than the entire human population of Newton County. It'll be, all this waste will be stored in a open-air waste lagoon that's more than 7 football fields in size, right next to where people do bird watching, where there's, you know, critical habitat, and so much effort in recent years to bring that beautiful area, once the Grand Kankakee Marsh, you know, just a beautiful, pristine area back to its former beauty. So it's a real shame that this has been allowed to proceed.
So it's even more important to be able to give the Indiana Department of Environmental Management the authority to be able to keep an eye, and a closer eye in this case, on this operation as it gets built and gets in operation, as well as all the others that are out there already in operation around Indiana. It's certainly important, and that's what this House Bill 1378, if it is passed through committee and makes it to the floor of the Indiana House, and then gets passed by the House and it gets sent on to the Indiana Senate, or if a companion bill over in the Senate is considered as well, that maybe there's a possibility, if it's all enacted, that the Governor Holcomb will be able to sign into law some teeth for IDEM to be able to deal with. And as you say, it will benefit not only the CAFOs that have already, I guess, been in operation, and the ones that are proposed, certainly, because the law will be in effect then, but it'll give residents a chance to speak out better and have some teeth in their opportunities to keep an eye on these things.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And for people who care about this issue, we urge them to reach out to their own state lawmakers and ask them to support House Bill 1378, and certainly critically right now to reach out to the members of the House Environmental Affairs Committee that will be hearing this bill, we believe, on February 13th.
We understand, too, that the chairman of the House Environmental Affairs Committee has already come out on record and saying that he'll allow that to be brought up for discussion and possibly for a vote.
I don't know that the bill will get a vote. We certainly hope that it will. It certainly will get a hearing. Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself is progress, because last year a similar bill was introduced and it didn't even get a hearing. We're hopeful with these baby steps and understand that this is, probably a long-term fight to get this legislation passed, but this is a good first step.
Well, as I know, in other past measures that have come up before the General Assembly, and as one learned state lawmaker once said, it sometimes it takes more than one, maybe two or even three General Assembly sessions to get a measure through it and get it enacted into law. So if this has gone through at least a couple times already, this or at least it's close to getting towards that point that it might actually become a law.
We certainly hope so.
We're talking with Kim Ferraro. She is the Agriculture Policy Director and the Senior Staff Attorney for the Hoosier Environmental Council. We're referring to what is referred to in the record as House Bill 1378. It's a bill that's been sponsored by two state lawmakers from eastern Indiana that would address some of the serious gaps in Indiana's current environmental law that deals with factory farm pollution. And, of course, we're watching it closely because of such an operation that is being set up in Newton County. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we hope that you can join us tomorrow for Reporters Roundtable Thursday.
Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, wherever you are. Visit Lake.